Okay, Lilith, it's yours.
Okay.
If you hear some beeps, you might remind people to go on mute.
Okay, all right. So my name is Lily Swan, and I play harp at the bedside, and I also sing from time to time. I sing mostly as a performer, and sometimes I sing at bedside as well. So I'm really excited to address this topic. Remember to put your call on mute, please. I'm excited to address this topic of vocal music at the bedside because I think as vocalists, we're more likely to run into being perceived as bedside entertainment than folks who are just instrumentalists. So we just need to think about that and think about what we're bringing to the bedside. And for me, I always like to just come back to my intent. And my intent at the bedside is to bring some measure of comfort, to help soothe in some way, or to lighten the mood, somehow to bring some comfort. So that is the first consideration. So when we walk into a room, we can tell by our observation whether somebody is resting or whether they're agitated. And from that observation, and determine what kind of music we want to do for them. If they're already in a restful state, then we're going to work at pulse tempo, therapeutic pulse rate, which is between 60 to 80 beats per minute. If they're agitated, we can use non-rhythmic music to help them let go of their anxiety. And then gradually go into pulse rate. So that's the same as for instrumentalists. From there, we start breaking things down a little bit more. Do we want the music to be familiar or unfamiliar? Major or minor? These kind of considerations. And with vocal music, we also have the element of words, which is a really important consideration. We need to understand what words do to help us decide whether to use them or not. So words connect us with waking consciousness. They engage the conscious mind. So sometimes that can be helpful. And sometimes, you know, people just need to rest. So we have to decide whether to sing a song with words or not. So some of the cases where I would use words would be definitely with dementia patients, advanced dementia patients in elder care, really benefit from old familiar tunes, and they generally benefit. We don't really know how they're going to respond. We might sing something that reminds them of something sad, you know, and we can't really anticipate that. So I had one mentee tell me a story about singing Camptown Races for an elder with dementia. And the woman just started laughing, and she remembered that she and her sister used to sing that song while milking their cow so that they could keep time. So they would sing Camptown Races while milking the cow. So they all got a good laugh out of that. So what happens with the familiar music is it creates associations. And sometimes it can be really emotional. Sometimes it'll remind somebody of a loved one that's gone now, you know, and it'll bring up some tears. And that's not a bad thing. It's just something that we can be aware of. So the advanced dementia patients can benefit from music with words. I actually shadowed a friend of mine who sings at the bedside, and she sang lots of songs about angels. And this was a good Sam. Good Samaritan nursing home. And so a lot of the folks there were really comforted by those songs about the angels. So that was nice. And then...
excuse me, Lily. If there's anyone who does not have their phone on mute, I hear some background noise. Please do put your phones on mute.
Okay, so this friend of mine, she would even sing John Prine's Making an Angel that comes from Montgomery. So even though that's more of a, I think it came out in the 70s or the 80s, these people could still appreciate that comforting image of the angels. So some people are really comforted by that, and then some people might not be. Okay. And sometimes, you know, often our own associations with music will guide us in our decisions. So always keep uppermost in mind our intent to soothe. So when we sing music with words, we do run the risk of being perceived as bedside entertainment. So it's helpful to provide a little introduction sometimes to let people know that we are in the background, that no applause or participation is necessary. We really don't want to be there to be a walking jukebox. We more want to be a walking spa. And let's see, another group of patients that can benefit from music with words are patients who are agitated. Sometimes they need words to connect to before we can segue into wordless tunes to help them relax. So mute your phone, please.
There's somebody who has a mail in the background. Huh? Please pay attention and mute your phone. Thank you.
So, and one of my mentees told me that he sings a song about breath, and it helps people to remember to focus on their breath. And so then from that point, he can go into wordless tunes after he's gotten them to focus on their breath and then get them to relax. I have a friend who's a hospice nurse, and she told me a story about a patient who was being bathed. And I think when we get to that point in hospice where we're so dependent on others that we can't take care of ourselves, we can't bathe ourselves, it can be uncomfortable. You know, it's really hard for people to get to that point of feeling helpless or powerless. And so what my friend did was she and her other nurse buddies started singing songs about water. And it just lightened the whole mood. It made the patient aware that people were having fun doing what they were doing. So it just changed what could have been a tense or uncomfortable situation to something that was more fun. So, and then the wordless music, what it does is it can really help people to drift off into sleep. And in most, please mute your phone. In most situations when we're in the hospital or in hospice, the patients really need to rest. And especially in the hospital, they need to rest so that they can heal. So it's really important to be able to be comfortable doing wordless tunes and making the voice just an instrument, maybe singing on vowel sounds. So I wanted to take a tune that I like that's a lullaby called The Sleepless Sailor and show you, make a little segue from the words into the wordless. So it goes, I once was a sailor, young man and brave, da-da-dum-dee, my night was all peaceful, my sleep I did crave, getting me off to sleep, da-da-dum-dee. Da-da-dum-dee, drift away, sail away, on the deep sea. Worry no more, for you sit now with me, rest in my arms and my feet, in my sleep. So I would continue on that way and drift more into the wordless and slow into a tempo that would encourage deep rest and sleep. So that's just a way we can start off with singing words that provide some imagery, because the words can provide a distraction for people from their pain too, when they're in that waking consciousness where they need something like that to connect to. And once they've connected with it, we can just help them to follow the voice and drift on off to deep rest or sleep. So, and more often than not, our work at the bedside will call for wordless music because the patients in the hospital need rest. So that's about what I have prepared. Are there questions?
I have a question. This is Betsy in Pennsylvania. Hi.
Betsy, how are you?
I'm good. I'm thinking about the way we improvise with music. And I'm just wondering if you ever improvise with words. Have you ever, or can you imagine being in a situation where you think, oh, a water thing, but I don't know any water song, so I'll just make up a water song. Has that ever happened? And
That is such a great question. I think some people would probably be really good at improvising words like that. I'm not necessarily. Most of the boys I know are. a lot of guys can take off on any song and just spoof on it or come up with something. What was I going to say about that? Coming up with words. I could definitely improvise on the music part of it. Singers generally have a pretty good repertoire, so we're not usually at a loss. Like right now, I can think of several water tunes. But in the moment, it doesn't necessarily come to our mind. So, and when I was shadowing my friend at Good Sam, I noticed because she was singing and playing guitar, and she was more bedside entertainment, which is not a bad thing. People just loved her. But people would ask for specific tunes. They'd say, do you know any Hank Williams or Johnny Cash? And she'd say, no, but I know, this one that you might like. And she'd sing something sort of in that vein. So, we don't always have to get real specific with the situation. Again, I would come back to the intent to soothe. That's kind of the center, the core that I try to anchor to wherever I am. And if I'm at a loss, then I just stop and ask for guidance in my mind. I just say, what can I do? Because sometimes we get to that point, too. So, great question.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
This is Bonnie in Pennsylvania. Hi, Betsy.
Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, one of the things that I've run into a couple times playing harp at the bedside, like I'll go into the ICU with a severe, a patient that, is really severely ill, and they don't want the harp because I think they're afraid, like it connotates death.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, like singing angel songs, have you ever had that experience?
Now, I haven't done that. My friend who was singing for the elders in elder care went in and sang angel songs. I would not do that in the ICU unless specifically requested. That's like a hymn. You have to be really careful about the content. So,
yeah.
And there are different associations. I only had one experience in ICU where a woman just sat straight up in bed and stared at me and with a look of fear on her face. And, a lot of these folks, they're medicated or they're in and out of altered states where they are. And I turned to her husband and I said, can you please let her know that you can see me too? Because she just, she looked at me like she had seen a ghost or an angel had that concern. So in that case, it would be the same as singing or playing a hymn. I would not do it unless specifically requested.
And I just want to mention, too, that I've been reading a lot about singing and talking and, that it's a different part of the brain. And I know with aphasics, they might not be able to talk, but they'll be able to sing. And I've talked to a couple people who've had that experience where all of a sudden they'll be able to, somebody won't be able to talk, but then they'll hear a familiar tune and they'll start to sing words. And I just wondered if you had had that experience at all.
I have not directly had that experience, but I just watched a wonderful film called Music Instincts that I highly recommend. It's you can stream it through Netflix. It's a PBS production that just came out a couple years ago, and they talk about that very thing, and they have an example of a woman who, before her musical therapy, couldn't get her needs met, couldn't ask for a glass of water. But with being able to sing her request as a melody and tap out the syllables with her left hand, she was able to ask, you know, ask to get her needs met, which was just amazing. It was a huge breakthrough for her to be able to communicate. So yes, it is. Music's a different part of the brain.
Thanks.
Sure. Anything else?
Hi, this is Lisa in Oklahoma. Do you, when you use your voice at the bedside, do you do that separate from harp, or do you sometimes combine the two and maybe end with
I definitely combine the two and use the harp as an accompaniment. I also, my friend who is a singing nurse does a lot of a cappella stuff, so it doesn't really matter. You can do either. You can have a, you know, an accompaniment instrument like a guitar or a harp, or you can just sing. So what it depends on your own comfort level too.
Could you provide an example of something vocally you would do for non-rhythmic?
Sure. So with non-rhythmic, I'm just going to take a piece that I do on harp, Eleanor Plunkett. La da 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 da. Draw the notes out, give lots of space, no discernible beat, just an easy flow with the rhythm. I've talked about non-rhythmic before being like rubato, and rubato is an Italian word that means robbed. So we're robbing time from one note to be paid back later with another note. So you can make the time pretty elastic with the non-rhythmic style. So does that help? Is that a long enough example?
Yeah, it's just okay. Right, just like you would with the harp. I was just curious how you did it vocally.
Yeah, and you know, practicing for this call, I was really thinking about the music without words, and it's something that I had to practice a little bit, but not that much. It's so much easier than I thought it would be to just drift into a wordless, you know, humming or on the vowel sound, an ooh or an ah or a la-la or a da-da, just, you know, something wordless. So it's pretty simple to just drift into that. Any other questions?
I'm curious, Linda. Probably a question for Dee. How many people actually do voice as opposed to an instrument? Do we have a sense for that?
That's
a good question.
You know, there are not many people who have actually certified on voice only, but we have several folks who are vocalists and harpists. I have two in Denver that I've worked with recently, and the results are exquisite. What they do is sometimes use voice and harp more as you know, with voice and then some cording behind it, and sometimes they do voice only, and sometimes they do harp only. So it extends the variety that they're able to offer. And they, my experience of listening to them is that it is like having a lullaby. It's just, it is so beautiful and so soothing. And I talked with a person who focuses on voice, not in the program, the other day. And one of the things she said is that they have, in her experience, she's found that sometimes voice is a degree more intimate than an instrument alone. So that was kind of an interesting point of view.
That's been my experience, too. And, you know, the first time I sang for somebody was when I was at a loss. I was praying for a woman who was in so much pain. She was really distracted by it and was so agitated. And I played for a good 20 minutes with no effect. And that happens sometimes. And we just really want to help, you know. And it's so hard to have that feeling of not being able to make a difference. And so I stopped for a moment and did my, you know, asked for guidance. What can I do? And I just thought, well, I'll sing to her. And I sang her a song, and it was an unfamiliar song, but it had poetic imagery in it. And she latched onto that imagery, and it distracted her from her pain in that moment, and she started to calm down. And that was, you know, that was the first I was able to have an effect. And it's interesting to me because, as I said in the beginning, I'm a performer as a vocalist. And so for the longest time, when I would play at bedside, I would really separate the two, and I would think, well, this is harp, and that is performance over there. You know, voice is performance. And it just didn't really dawn on me to combine the two. But as he said, I think the voice just has such a human quality, such an intimacy about it, a warmth. So, yeah.
And can I just make a point? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. This is Bonnie again. I play for patients who are awake and aware, and I'll play a tune, and they'll want to sing it. And I find that if I sing it, if I see that they want to sing it, but they're sort of they're conscious about it, I'll start to sing it with them and say, come on, sing it with me. And it will encourage them to sing as well. And I think, talk about intimacy. I mean, the fact that you're interacting on that level, I think, is very powerful. And I've had some really good experiences with that. And then I've also had patients who are interested in the whole field of music and sound and healing. And I'll use tone with them. We're all like, you know, start at the C and have them hum to that and ask them where they feel it in their body. And then, people are really fascinated by it, and it gives them another tool. You know, if you have pain in a place, just come into it and give them those types of techniques. So I've used sound in that way.
Absolutely. That's great. Yeah, and it's wonderful to be able to connect with people that way if they do want to participate, you know, if they're awake and aware, like you're saying. That's great. I just love this work so much because it gives us an opportunity to have intimate connections with people that we otherwise wouldn't even meet. You know, we wouldn't have any contact with them, and then suddenly we're in this situation where we're touching their heart. It's just, it's beautiful.
And I'll just share with you, too, and everybody on the line, my husband's a physician at the hospital where I volunteer. And he came home one day, and he goes, why is it every time you're up on the floor is playing the harp, everyone's crying? And I just thought that was really kind. He says, it seems like it really moves everybody's emotions. And I said, well, yeah, that's a good thing, you know. But I just thought it was interesting that he noticed that.
Right. Yeah. Well, you're leaving people crying in your wake.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a good thing, yeah.
It is good. It's wonderful. There are so many people who are just trying to keep it together, be stoic. And, I mean, if I were in the hospital with an illness or an injury, I sure would be scared. So it's really good to facilitate that kind of release.
This is Linda. Sarah. Can you hear me? Sarah. This is Linda Bellingham.
Hi.
Are you hearing me?
Uh-huh.
Oh, good. Okay. I was certified with voice and guitar with you, and one thing that my main work has been with the Threshold Choir singers. So I direct the choir here in Bellingham of people who go to the bedside, And we sing at the bedside in small groups of 2 to 4 people. And I'm guessing some of you on this call may know about the Threshold Choir movement. But if people want to know more about that, it's thresholdchoir.org. And you can learn a lot about this kind of singing of bringing just a small group, never more than 4, to sing in a certain way with a certain repertoire. And half the repertoire for the Threshold Singers has been written by people who do this work. So just wanted to put in a plug for people who may not know about that.
Thank you so much. That's wonderful. Any other questions?
Louis?
Yes.
Hi. I just coughed. Sorry. I didn't realize I was off mute. This is Beth in San Diego.
Hi.
I come from a classical background, and I was excited to hear, because so much of my repertoire is in, because of my world music interest and my opera interest is in different languages. So there are these beautiful songs that are in Italian or whatever, and I also have a bunch of lullabies in different languages, so I would love to use them without the words because they still have the intent and the beauty of the tune.
Right.
Do you sometimes use wordless songs after you showed us that segueing into wordless,
right.
And did you continue with wordless tunes?
Yes.
Because I love to be able to use that repertoire, but I understand, like, the value of the words.
Right. Well, the value of the words, though, is at that cognitive level. And if they're in a different language, then you're doing what would be unfamiliar. And I know in the Chalice of Repose program, they use Latin. They sing in Latin. And so, and part of the purpose of that is the same thing as using the wordless is that it allows people to let go. So, you know, to not latch on to something familiar. So, I can see that would be helpful.
So I would think that singing in another language would be kind of confusing because I don't know about you, but when I hear things in other languages, I'm trying to figure out if it's not English, what language it is and kind of.
Right.
Survive a bit.
It kind of depends on the pacing of it, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's nice and slow and you're shaping the vowels and focusing on that, then that can help you. Help them to let go. I was actually on the African Lullabies album. So.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. What language?
Well, it's the woman was from Nigeria. And I played harp on it.
Oh, wow. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
I was also curious, sometimes, like, I personally don't love ballads because, just to sing. Do you find there's, like, a place for ballads versus other songs?
You're talking about with words, right?
Well, or both. I guess it depends.
Or either one. I guess it would depend on the ballad, like the one that I sing, Eleanor Plunkett, the harp one that I do, that I just did as a wordless tune, as a non-pulse arrangement. I would consider that a ballad, and I would be fine with that. I guess it just depends on the tune. So, you know, a lot of this we kind of do by feel as we go along. And like I said, when you walk into the room, you want to make an observation. Is the person resting or are they agitated? And based on that, go from there. If they're resting, do the pulse tempo. If they're agitated, do the non-pulse. And then you can break it down from there and say, you know, do I want to do major or minor? And kind of go by feel and then watch them. Watch their facial expression. Listen to them. If they're moaning, does their moaning subside? You know, if they're clenching their fists, do their fists relax? Do their facial muscles relax? And if not, then move in another direction. You know, if you're doing a minor, maybe try a major, for example. So,
this is Dee. I would think also around ballads. I mean, you wouldn't want to use. I wouldn't think Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley.
No.
Or some of those familiar, really familiar ballads, because you've got all of the issues with familiarity plus the subject matter of the ballad. So
exactly.
I would think that ballads as a type of music, the appropriateness of them depends on are they familiar or not familiar, and then how you deliver them.
And that's the nice thing about doing wordless music, too, is it gives us one less thing to have to focus on as musicians, because we have a lot going on. So when we're using words, we're doing an interpretation of the music, too. It's one more step that we have to consider how we're delivering the words. So I like going into the wordless realm, too.
With the six, like, you know, 60, 70 approximately beats per minute. Sometimes I don't know exactly how to pace it, even if I have my, you know, like I'll practice with my little light. I have a snark tuner that has a little heart that does the beat, you know, without the noise. And sometimes it's like, am I going, do I do double time? Do I do quarter time? Do I, you know,
if you
could give an example of like a really familiar song in, you know, because I know with the harp, you know, Dee's mentioned as slow almost as you can, you know, like 60 ends up being almost as slow as you can stand playing it, you know, kind of thing.
Exactly, right. It's like a dirge. So here's row, row, row your boat at about, I'm going to guess 60 beats per minute, okay.
Okay.
La 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 la. And the same with songs too, like if you're doing a children's song like that. And you're using words, for example, like twinkle, twinkle, or one of those. You're going to want to do it slow anyway. As vocalists, as performers, we're used to going at least 80 beats a minute or faster. It's more comfortable for us to be at that pace. But when you're singing for little kids or for elders, they're trying to shape the words. They're trying to remember. So if you slow it way down, it gives them a chance to be a part of that. If you're doing something familiar, or for elders, if you're doing Red River Valley, or You Are My Sunshine, one of those that's really familiar, you want to keep it at that, around 60 beats per minute. And I know that feels really dirge-like when you're first doing it, but it's so relaxing, and that's really the pace where you start to see some pretty dramatic results. Like people at least deeply resting, if not falling sound asleep. So.
Awesome. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. This is so wonderful to have all these singers and curious instrumentalists as well. Anything else?
Oh, it's Beth again. I was curious if you would be able to post on the discussion group, possibly maybe like just off the cuff, kind of a top 10, you know, like great songs to know kind of thing.
Oh, wow. For familiar things? Well,
yeah.
Beatles, right? Anything. well, and then in the hymn category, of course, Amazing Grace. What am I thinking? Top 10. I guess it would depend on who you're singing for, too.
Yeah.
So,
sometimes
pretty much, go ahead.
With people with experience, like I asked my harp teacher, you know, what are, like, the ones that everybody, you know, it just seems like almost everybody is like, oh, you know, I love that song. And
right.
And some of those kind of surprised me, and it was neat because she has such, you know, so many years of experience, so I was curious. And it's not that you have to come up with them right now. I was just wondering if maybe you could post that or get it to me, or I could post it on the mail.
Absolutely.
I've sung America the Beautiful a couple times, and that really hits people. I don't know if anyone else had that experience.
Hmm.
I live in a military town. Maybe that's why.
Oh, Well, there you go, yeah. And I know, you know, after 9/11, that song just really was like wildfire across the country and united people, you know, so there's that strength, I think, that people feel with that song, too.
And then also...
Yeah, that's one of my... Sorry, that's one of America's Beautiful is one of my standards. We have two big VA hospitals that I play in, and I usually go in that with that. Yeah.
Yep.
And who is that speaking?
Oh, that was Betsy in Pennsylvania again.
Thank you. I thought it was. So I'm sure.
Edelweiss is another one that I think is popular.
Edelweiss?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Morning is Broken, I would think, is another one that people would enjoy.
Maybe, Lily, with a little more thought, you might come up with a top group.
Uh-huh.
And then I can, when I send out information on the call recording, I can include that.
Absolutely.
This is Colleen in Phoenix.
Hi, Colleen.
I've always thought about adding a little song or something, a little singing to my work, just for all of the reasons that we've been talking about tonight. And I just have to share a little story. I was playing for a gal in hospice a while back, and really, really old gal, and she asked me if I sang, and I told her no, that I didn't, and she's like, well, at least hum then. She was insistent on it, you know. So I think I'm going to have to start getting a little braver with my voice.
Yeah. Well, and just spend some time at home doing it so that you can get comfortable with your own sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's key. You don't want to walk in cold.
Yeah, it was so funny. No, she's like, well, at least come.
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, that's what they say in Africa. If you can walk, you can sing. If you can talk, you can sing. If you can walk, you can dance. So
there you go.
It's just such a, you know, separated out part of our culture. Like, music is over here. There are places in the world where it's just part of everything. So part of the work, they divide it up so that half the people are doing the work and the other half are singing and playing for them. So, great.
Hi, this is Samantha in California.
I think
maybe you could add to your top 10 would be the song Que Sera Sera.
Oh, sure.
Because I have found, even though I don't sing it, I found this one that they all seem to love when playing harp. And another thing I wonder that might easily transfer from what I have done on harp to singing, because I've thought, you know, if I added vocal to what I'm doing after I, you know, go through on the harp. Especially if you live in a scenario like I do, because I'm in Long Beach, and if we have kind of an international city where we have a lot of cultures here.
Sure.
And as much as you can learn songs from the different cultures, and I try to go for folk songs from the childhoods of those cultures.
That's great.
You know, because that's something that's innocuous. You know, it's not going to be offensive to anybody.
Right.
But it's going to be something that's going to touch their heart.
It's going to bring them some joy that you have taken the time to learn that. That's so special.
Right, right, and make them feel comfortable with, I gleaned through the books, because I've been a music teacher from when I had taught the children international songs, I do that, but also I've found that, you know, on YouTube now, there's more and more and more people posting up songs from different cultures. And you can look that up, and you can look on websites for information that way, too. Mm-hmm. And that might be helpful. Even if you could not sing the actual words, just humming the tune, or, you
right.
know, doing la la's or oohs.
Right.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Had,
yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Okay.
I had the experience of being on a cruise ship a couple years ago. My aunt took me to Paris, and it was so special. And most of the people on the crew were from Czechoslovakia. And so they were learning all of these. It was Christmas time, and they were learning all of these Christmas tunes. And, of course, they didn't know any of them. And I could hear them. I was up in the middle of the night because I had jet lag. And I could hear them practicing, and it was just so heartwarming that they would, you know, take the time to learn the language and learn the songs, and it was just very special. So I think that's such a good call to learn the childhood ones, too, because like you say, they're going to be inoffensive, and they're going to be heart-opening. You know, they'll more likely bring some joy, delight. So, and we have different patient populations. I know here in Arizona, we have a pretty large Latino population, and so they can really, you know, benefit from hearing their own music too, brings them some comfort. So that's a really good point. Anything else?
Hello, Lily?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Janice, and I am also from Pennsylvania.
Hi, Janice.
Hi. I'd like to focus on something that you had said, and then Dee had commented on that. And this is actually, I kind of know the answer, but it's always nice to hear somebody else's perspective, especially a vocalist. When you're singing something and there's a response from the person you're singing for, and you get affected, now you're using your breath and your articulators, even if you're doing oohs, your body to keep your posture up. How do you not get affected and alter the sound that's coming out of you?
So when you're saying they respond, like for example, in any way, or?
Well, I have, one particular example. I was working with somebody who was in a transition unit from going from a hospital to get some more care before she went home.
Uh-huh.
She turned out to be a classical musician who had severe arthritis, and her hands were crippled, and she was there to learn. She was having problems walking, so she needed to get strength in walking. So I go into the room, and she immediately says, "Okay, entertain me." Now, Arnie, I feel my throat closing up. Okay. And I noticed she has a Star of David necklace on her neck, and I've got a cross. I'm like, okay, what can I possibly do to this lady? What could I say?
All right, right.
So the next question is, well, I introduced myself and why I was there, and then I said, well, what kind of music do you like to listen to? And then, of course, she went on to say that she was a classical piano player, and she listens to WBIA, which is one of our public broadcast stations. And then she was a piano teacher, and I'm looking at this little woman in this wheelchair, all crippled.
Right.
So, and I'm thinking, okay, the only classical piece I could possibly do at this time is Ave Maria, but I see the Star of David on her neck.
Right, that won't work, right.
That's not going to work. So I said, you know, I just started singing,
Come Rain or Come Shine.
Oh, sweet.
I'm like just singing this, and I'm maybe 6 or 8 measures in, you know. I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you. And then she just starts bawling.
Oh.
She just starts having a cathartic experience.
Wow.
And I don't know what to do because I immediately go into myself, did I do something wrong? Is this the wrong song? You know, all of these questions happen so fast. In your
right. How do you respond? I got you now.
How do you respond? So now, yeah, but my throat's closing up again, my body posture's changing. In a New York second, all of this is happening.
Right.
And I just kept singing the song, and the voice was cracking, but that was okay because it wasn't a performance. It was
Right, go ahead.
No, you go. So I guess, I mean, I kind of know the answer, but how does, as a vocalist, does it get easier?
Well, that is such a good question, and my first response to that is that there's really no right way, and we are going to respond to people. If they start cheering up, sometimes we're going to cheer up, and when we take our hospice courses, they let us know, you know, don't like, cry more than the other person. You don't want to lay your troubles on them. So that's really important to keep the focus on them and try to facilitate that moment for them, whatever's coming up for them, and to be present for them. And I think it's fine that your voice cracks a little. It's part of being human, and it's part of being connected in that way. So that's my first response to that, is that is going to happen. And so as far as, like, overcoming it, I guess if you had more situations like that come up, then you would have more practice in it. I think that, it doesn't always happen that way. And so was this the first time that you sang for a person, or this is just an example of what?
That was the first time that I had that response from a song.
Uh-huh.
Like that.
Yeah. See, and that's the thing with familiar music. It's unpredictable. And music can bring up intense emotions like that. And the thing with playing for people who are in the hospital or hospice, a lot of what I've noticed in there is that people are alone. Even if they have family in town, their family can't always come visit them like that. After work or whatever. And so here's this person walking in with an instrument or their voice bringing them music. I mean, they just break in too. It's just that somebody would do that for them. And that's the difference with the live music as opposed to a cassette or something. You know, so I don't know if that's the answer that you were expecting, but my take is just be human and stay connected to your own authenticity. And try to be present for the person, you know, and be as strong as you can, obviously, but not in a way that's unreal. You know, the strength of the ride is just going to come from your core.
This is Dee, and I'm going to offer one. Everything that Lily has said, I would agree with, but I think there is one thing that we can use when we get into a situation like that where we're becoming emotional and we want some way to step back. In neurolinguistic programming, they have what they call the thinking model. And what they determined in the course of developing that methodology is that when we do internal processing, visually, auditorially, or kinesthetically, our eyes automatically go to a physical place. Our visual processing is up, and for most of us, memory is to the left, and making new things up is to the right. And auditory processing is ear to ear, same pattern. Most of us process memory on the left and make things up on the right. A few of us reverse that, and it's fine. It doesn't matter. It's important to know what you do. And one of the things to know is that when we go into kinesthetic processing and our emotions, we, and especially any kind of bad feelings, we go down. Our eyes go down. So when you get into an emotional state and you want to be able to moderate that, one of the things to do on your own time is experiment around with what happens if you physically put your eyes ear to ear, and what happens if you look up to the left or you look up to the right. And my experience for me is that when I go into visual space, it absolutely disconnects whatever that emotion was that I was feeling. I mean, I did an experiment. I had studied this and knew the theory of it and never used it. And I did an experiment one day when I was out with my husband and we were out, you know, doing errands and having a good time. And we had some little spat and I got, you know, I said, oh, I ought to use this. And I noticed that as long as I was feeling badly, my eyes were down. And as soon as I shifted my eyes into auditory and then up to visual, it was like somebody just cut off the electricity to that feeling. And I...
Do you go auditory first and then visual, or does it matter?
Well, you go up and try it yourself. You don't have to go... You know, I mean, the fact that your eyes go up, you can do that really fast so that you just whip by auditory. For me, auditory often has memories, and that's part of where the emotion comes from. For other people, it may be different. So for me, the most resourceful place for me to be is up in visual processing. But if you move your eyes, the point is move your eyes out of the downward physical position. And if you try it on, you know, you hate eating split pea soup and just think about how it feels, you'll notice that your eyes are down doing that feeling. And then move your eyes up and see what happens to that whole emotion and that thought process. And chances are, you lose it. Now, if you go right back down into feelings, you're going to go back into the emotion. But if you stay up in visual, it will give you, I think, you'll find a little bit of space to just kind of focus yourself, ground yourself, and center yourself. But play with it on your own time. Don't wait until you get into a room. And certainly if you have a question about it or you want more information, you know, send me an email. There's a lot of literature about that, but it sounds really, really easy, but what they discovered in NLP is that the fastest way to change your state is by changing your physiology. And one of the
That's
ways
amazing.
To change your physiology is through your eye movements.
So it's just a practical tool that you can use to disengage in a way that's still supportive of the patient, but that helps you to ground and center more strongly in your own space. That's beautiful.
Well, thank you for that, Lily and Dee. Thank you.
You're welcome. We have about 4 minutes left. Is there any last question or comment?
This is Betsy again. I seem to be verbose tonight, but I don't know if people are familiar with a singer named Ruth Cunningham. She was one of the founders of a group called Anonymous Four, but what Ruth is doing now is some of the kinds of work we do. I'd just like to recommend, and Dee, maybe we can get it up on in the discussion group, she has a CD called Heart Modes, which is an example of every mode done with the combination of harp and voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty neat. It's pretty good. And it might be a way for some people to give people an idea of the wordless singing, but also it's a really helpful in terms of recognizing the modes, frankly.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And I think you can download it, too. So.
Okay.
What was the name of the artist?
Bruce Cunningham.
It's Bruce Cunningham.
Hi, it's Dee and Lily. It's Harriet in Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, I was just checking when you were just talking about the eyes and the downward looking. Is that something that you would be focusing on in your patient, that if they are looking in that downward direction, that it's a negative kind of thing?
No, Harriet, if they're looking, if anyone's looking downward,
yeah,
it doesn't mean anything except that they're engaging in kinesthetic processing. It doesn't mean positive or negative.
Okay, all right.
So, but what looking either into auditory or kinesthetic space does is detach you from whatever that emotion is. And I don't recommend trying to analyze what a patient is doing. Definitely in a counselor role, therapeutic role, that is one of the uses, that as a therapist you could look at a person and you could understand how are they referencing their information? Are they referencing pictures? Are they referencing sound? Are they referencing feeling? And that might help you in the therapeutic interaction, but we're not there for therapy. And I think we want to be concerned with using this for ourselves.
I see.
Because we're not there to change what a patient is doing from that standpoint. I mean, it could be useful and it certainly would be something to notice. But I think it's more for our benefit. And no matter what, even if you determine that someone is in visual processing or auditory or kinesthetic, it does not tell you what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's not our objective to try to change their behavior either.
No, it's just in documenting, you know, you have to kind of mark what you have observed that the music did. What were the reactions of the patient? So sometimes I might note that, you know, they were looking upward and towards the right or towards the left and, you know, kind of substantiating any kind of effect the music brought on.
I probably would not do that. Because I think that looking, wherever they're looking, unless you've done some calibration with them to know what their pattern is, you just really don't know.
Okay.
I mean, there's some general rules that can be helpful, but you don't know. And one of the things that would always happen in an interaction where eye signals are being used and monitored is calibration to know exactly how that person uses their eyes. And then you can ask a bunch of questions to find that out and then watch what they do with their eyes. So I would not go there.
Okay.
I would not include it with
a report,
With a report. Right. You might increasingly notice it and find out that it's a useful thing for you to notice. But I sure would not include it in reports.
And the other question, it was brought up about classical music. I'm given referrals from the nurses who are admitting hospice patients, and oftentimes they'll say, oh, they love classical music. So I'm not sure how to handle that because, you know, as what we do, and I'm a vocalist, but I don't go in and sing arias and things like that. It's a much more intimate kind of a thing. So I'm not sure how to address that.
Well, part of that is just with the staff. Staff is always going to need more education, but I think, you know, just a simple statement, if at all, I would just say, you know, we use really simple arrangements of music in order to facilitate rest. You know, just something simple like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just to let them know that, you know, this is not entertainment. This is service. It's different. And then the music will speak for itself. The effects will be seen by the staff when they come in to check on them. They'll see more of what you're doing. So, okay.
And Lily?
Uh-huh.
Lily, this is Beth Ford. You can also sing any classical piece in a calm, mellow, you know, quiet, soothing voice.
Right.
Some of those
right. It's not a performance. Right.
They would often be familiar with those people, obviously, you know, if they're singing something from an opera. But, you know, I mean, they're still beautiful tunes.
Like,
sure.
Anything you can think of off the top of your head?
Oh, well, Mio Bambino Caro, Che Faro, a really simple one that sometimes is in harp literature is Caro Ben.
I couldn't hear you. There's some noise. What was it?
I'll say it in English. Caro Mio Ben.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, things like that, or, the Oh, Mio Bambino
Caro. If you're not speaking, please put your phone on mute. We can hear background noise. Thanks.
I mean, just any of the ones people go, oh, or any of the things that have, Belle Nuit, the Barcarolle, people love that, the flower duet. And you can sing it, you can sing it down without having to go real high, of course.
Cause it's
hard to do quietly high. But, when I was singing busking in a Balboa Park here in San Diego, people loved Belle Nuit because it was in that movie Life is Beautiful, and people would come up to me and just go, oh, that song. So a lot of those, and you can ask harpists also what classical themes they do. Like Jupiter from Gustav Horsch. Anyway, there's a certain amount in the harp literature too that can be sung along with.
I'm going to interject that when people say what they know,
mm-hmm.
whether it's classical or bluegrass or hymns, people are only going to ask for or comment on what they know, and they have no idea what else is available. So I would really caution the response that, any kind of a, I don't mean to be negative, but a knee-jerk response to think that you have to respond
mm-hmm.
or that it's even necessarily appropriate to respond in that genre. It may be appropriate to do one thing and segue into something else. It doesn't matter whether it's classical or bluegrass. If it's familiar, one of the things that familiar music is going to do is exactly what Lily talked about with words. It's going to hook the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're playing for someone who really needs to leave their body because they're in pain
mm-hmm.
or they're going into transition, it may not be the best thing. Now, there's no rule that's an always, because there's a rule that says don't play something familiar when someone's actively dying.
Right.
Except I keep hearing stories of people who, in spite of their best judgment, go ahead and play that one thing that's been asked for, and the person passes. That is
right.
what they were waiting for. That's very comforting and soothing to them. So I think we always, it's a fine art. There's no one way to do things,
mm-hmm.
but I would just really caution against the knee-jerk response to do what's been asked.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because then you get in that role of being the walking jukebox, and you don't
mm-hmm.
really, that bedside entertainment is not what not really our intent.
I was trying to underline the fact that there are some beautiful tunes out there that can be sung even if it's not like, whoa, like I'm singing,
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. And I think we're at time. So I thank everyone for their participation, and Lily for facilitating the call, especially. And until next time.
Thanks,
everybody. Yeah. Bye.
Okay. Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.